She's held a number of senior positions in the government, including Assistant Secretary and Chief Financial Officer of the U.S. Department of Commerce, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Administration, and U.S. Representative to several high-ranking government commissions. She's also teaching now a number of policy-oriented courses at the Kennedy School. I also would like to add that last year, Professor Bilmes won and was awarded the American Friends Service Committee's annual Speaking Truth to Power Award. The American Friends Service Committee cited Professor Bilmes's, and I'm quoting, impressive scholarship on the economic cost of war and research on wounded veterans, your willingness to bring these important issues to the public arena, and your partnership in the Cost of War Project. Among her recent published works is the New York Times bestseller called The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraqi Conflict, which she wrote with Joseph Stiglitz. And thanks to the bookstore here at Lewis and Clark, there will be copies of this book for sale that Professor Bilmes has graciously offered to autograph and to for me to tell you that the proceeds of the sales of this book go to support wounded veterans, veterans suffering with disabilities. She also has a brand new book, which is not yet here, but will be out, I think, within the week, called The People Factor, Strengthening America by Investing in Public Services. So I think that one, given the kinds of issues that we're dealing with, is also going to be very important and very timely. Professor Bilmes will be speaking here tonight on the costs of war, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the U.S. economy. And please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you very much, Marty, and thank you for that very nice introduction, and thank you to the Lewis and Clark community for inviting me here for the Steinhardt Lecture. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to see you all. I also had the pleasure of meeting with a group of students at lunch and at dinner, and was very, very impressed by the depth of thought that the students showed, and I'm really delighted that you're all here to hear about this topic. There is, of course, a lot to say about the Iraq War. I mean, there is so much to say that it really is hard to keep this to 30 or 40 minutes, but I will try, you know, I've tried to put together a kind of distillation of some of the major findings of the book and some of the implications of the cost of the war on the economy. Afterwards, I'm happy to answer any questions on this or related topics. Please do, you know, feel free to jump in if there's something pressing as I'm speaking that you'd like to ask. Now, to get to the hardest part of the speech is always figuring out the new technology at a new auditorium. What I am going to be talking to you about tonight is four things. So what we're going to talk about is the cost of the war and, very importantly, how we paid for the cost of the war. And then think about some of the implications of those financing decisions and the implications for the economy. Now, can everybody hear me okay? Everybody in the back there? Yep, A-okay? Great. I want to start off by giving you a little background on the scale of the war. I see many people here in the community who probably have been involved in thinking about these issues. Many people in the economics department have been studying these issues. But let's just kind of start by thinking about the scale, the scope of the Iraq conflict, and compare it to other conflicts in U.S. history. This March, next week, will be the 6th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. That means that it's one of our longest wars. It's about twice as long as our involvement in World War II. Our involvement in World War I was just over two years. In Korea, was 3 years. Vietnam, which was our longest conflict, was 10 years. If you include the Afghanistan conflict, which we do to some extent in the cost of the wars, as we'll discuss shortly, we are now getting very close to the length of time of the Vietnam conflict. So it really has been a very long period of time. For many of you who are students, you have grown up with the Iraq War going on. It is also one of our most expensive wars. The only war which is more expensive that we have ever fought is the Second World War. which of course was a massive conflict involving 16 million Americans, and which cost about $3.3 trillion in today's dollars. The direct sort of upfront military costs of Iraq are going to be 50% higher than those of Vietnam, twice those of Korea, and four times that of World War I. And this is driven in part by the fact that the cost of per troop today is about $500,000 a year, compared to, for example, in World War II, it was $50,000 per troop in today's dollars. So the actual cost of deploying a troop is much more expensive, and we'll look at why that is. If we think about the war in terms of the scale, there are a lot of numbers that you see in the newspaper about how many troops there are. People tend to think, well, maybe there are 150,000 troops over there, something like that. We are, we've already had 1.8 million Americans deployed to this war. Of those, what is particularly unusual about this war is that more than a third have been in two or more tours of duty. A significant number of U.S. troops have been in three, four tours of duty. 25% of our troops deployed have been National Guards or reservists. These are people who are basically usually working in the community. Many of them are first responders in the community, and they have been in Iraq serving long tours of duty. About half of the U.S. troops have been discharged to date, about 900,000. These are sort of rounded numbers. Of those, about a third have filed disability claims already. More than a third have been treated at Veterans Department medical facilities already, of whom about 150,000 have been treated for mental health problems, largely post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. This slide is very important in terms of understanding the cost of the war, is to understand the casualty figures. The number of troops who have been killed in those two acronyms are Operation Iraqi Freedom, which is Iraq, and Operation Enduring Freedom, which refers to Afghanistan, and operations in and around Afghanistan, which is basically a euphemism for Pakistan. In Operation Iraqi Freedom, as we're familiar with, there have been 52, 55 fatalities, and you can see the number of those wounded, which is about 31,000. There have been overall, in the two operations, 33,815 troops who were wounded in hostile situations. Now, one of the very, very important points, and one of the points in which I have run into most conflict with the administration, has been on the definition of what is a wounding. The definition of what is a wounding, you can be killed in hostile or non-hostile environment. In other words, as I explained to the students at lunch, if your helicopter crashes into a mountain and you're killed, or if your helicopter is shot down, in either respect, if you were killed, you were up there in the death toll. But if your helicopter crashes into a mountain and you are wounded, as opposed to being wounded in the helicopter that shot down, you don't appear in the wounded line. You don't actually appear anywhere, which is why what you will see in the newspapers is you'll see the number 30,000, 33,000 wounded. In fact, all those other people who are wounded and injured seriously enough to require medical evacuation, but not in hostile situations, so things like transportation accidents, electrical accidents, if the shower that they are taking a shower in is poorly wired and they're electrocuted, they show up. You can only get that information by filing a Freedom of Information Act request. And if you bring in that whole group of people, the number of those who have been wounded, injured, or seriously ill is about 80,000. So it's a much, much larger number. Now, the distinction between how it's determined whether it is hostile or non-hostile is very arbitrary. For example, if we are traveling in a convoy and the truck in front of me hits an explosive device, and I'm wounded in that truck, that's a hostile wounding incident, so I would be in the wounded list. But if I'm in the truck below and I hit the truck in front of me, I hit the truck, not the explosive device, so that's considered a non-hostile wounding. So it's a very, very arbitrary distinction. And one of the issues in terms of how the war costs have been concealed that we discovered in the process of doing the research for the book was that, of course, regardless of how you were wounded, you were still eligible for and will receive disability benefits and health care benefits just the same. But the official numbers don't actually include that figure. Then you also have a number of contractors who have been killed and wounded, and it's even more difficult because of very, very scarce information about what has happened to them. The cost to date for the war, in terms of the upfront cost of what we have spent, is about $900 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan. And those are, I want to emphasize, upfront costs. In other words, that's money that has sort of been paid already. Now, the cost has gone up very, very much since the beginning of the war. It's gone up, it has quadrupled from $4.4 billion a month to $16 billion a month for a variety of reasons, increased wounding, increased fuel costs, increased repairs, increased wear and tear on equipment. But not because of the number of troops, because we basically have had about the same number of troops, around the 150,000 mark, deployed throughout the war. The cost projections are now roughly in line. Our cost that I will show you is about $3 trillion. The Joint Economic Committee of Congress has estimated $3.5 trillion. The Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, not counting economic costs, but only looking at budgetary costs, has cited a range of $1.8 to $2.3 billion. Now, I thought that I would try to run through a little bit about the cost of the war in two ways. Talk to you about it for a minute, and then there's an organization called Good Videos that has made a video essentially of the methodology of the $3 trillion war, which takes 2 minutes and we can watch it, that really explains the components of this. But there are essentially three types of costs of the Iraq War. There are the upfront budgetary costs. Upfront budgetary cost is basically the operating costs of waging war. This is paying not the military, the ordinary military, because we pay them anyway, but paying supplementary combat pay to regular military people. It's paying all of the reservists and the guards who normally get paid for 1 weekend a month, but we pay them a full-time salary now. It's paying for the equipment, it's paying for the fuel, it's paying for building the bases. We built 165 bases in Iraq. It's paying for the contractors who are working there. It's paying for all of the laundry, the food, the equipment. It's paying for the Iraqi security forces who we pay. It's paying for all of the coalition members, because everybody else in the world who is involved in Iraq in any way apart from Britain is actually paid by the U.S. So those are all the upfront operating costs. What is not counted, and that would refer to the 900 or so billion, are two second and very important components of cost. First of all, there are long-term costs. These are largely fall into three categories. First, there are the long-term costs of paying for veterans. Now, a veteran who comes home wounded is entitled to receive two things. First of all, they're entitled to receive disability benefits, disability compensation, for the rest of their lives. Second of all, they're entitled to receive medical care, initially for 5 years, and if eligible, for the rest of their lives. Now, those are long-term costs which go up over time. We just last year finished paying the last veteran from the War of 1812, the last survivor of the veteran. We pay more than $4 billion a year in disability benefits to Gulf War veterans, and that war only lasted for a month. We pay $26 billion a year to Vietnam veterans, and that is going up every year. And these are just in disability benefits, not counting medical care. So the cost is a very real long-term cost. Second, there's the cost of replenishing all of the military equipment that's been used up. And we have used up military equipment at about 10 times the peacetime rate, and we are replacing it much, much slower. So one thing you can be sure of is that all of that stuff is going to be replaced. And in many cases, it has already been ordered, but we haven't paid for it yet. The third major piece of cost which we will have to pay, and this is a subject we will come back to because it directly affects the economic situation, is that we borrowed all the money to go to war. So we, of course, have got to pay that money back with interest. Now, third, there are social and economic costs. Social costs are things like, for those who have come back wounded, about 20% of them have had a family member, a spouse, a parent, leave their job in order to become a full-time caregiver. Now, that's a cost that that person pays. The government doesn't pay it, but it's a cost. There is the cost of the loss to the economy, of the loss of those who have been killed or seriously wounded in terms of the economic benefit that they will provide to the economy. And there are macroeconomic costs in terms of the amount that we have pulled out of the economy for the war as opposed to the amount we've put in. This is a sort of a more comprehensive list, you know, of the ones that we have looked at on the budgetary side. As I was describing, there's the money we've spent. There are also future costs of running the war. There are also an additional significant portion of costs that the Defense Department has spent, which are not related specifically to the war, but they are related to the war, like increased recruiting costs, for example, which will go on for a long time. Which wouldn't have happened if not for the war. And then there are a variety of economic costs. For example, if a soldier is killed in the war, their family will receive $500,000. It's $100,000 in what is called a death gratuity and $400,000 in life insurance. If, that's assuming that the soldier remembered to sign up for life insurance when he signed up. If he didn't, they don't get anything except the death gratuity, but most sign up. But that $500,000, which is what kind of shows up on the books, is actually, from an economic perspective, doesn't reflect the loss of a young life. Now, the way that the government accounts for that loss in the civilian world, like if they're looking at the Environmental Protection Agency or the Food and Drug Administration, when they're approving of drug, for example, and they try and estimate how many people might be killed by a side effect, the amount they estimate per life is $7 million. That's the standard amount using an economic tool that some of you may have studied called the value of statistical life. And although it seems kind of cold-hearted to say that a life is worth $7 million, it's also not correct to, from an economic costing perspective, to say that the value of a young life lost is nothing. It's certainly more than the $500,000. So what I'm going to do now is show you this little video so you can sort of understand this $3 trillion war, and then we're going to kind of move to the next stage and try and think about the implications of it.
In 2003, Donald Rumsfeld estimated a war with Iraq would cost $60 billion. 5 years later, the cost of Iraq war operations is over 10 times that figure. Factoring in the Afghanistan war, total operations are at $800 billion. By the time the U.S. leaves Iraq, the estimated cost of war will be $3 trillion. One, start with the total operational costs to date, including tanks, combat pay, military training, military bases, and embassies. Two, add additional military costs outside war spending. The military's budget is rising at a rate faster than any time over the last 40 years, and you can attribute that indirectly to the war. Three, correct for inflation over the past 5 years. Four, add operational and peacekeeping costs before and after the troops withdraw, since it's estimated that the U.S. will stay in Iraq in some capacity for another decade. Five, add future health care for approximately 2.1 million returning veterans affected by war. Six, add cost of restoring the military back to pre-war strength, because the Defense Department is not replacing equipment as fast as it's used. 7. Add Social Security to veterans who can no longer work. The total cost of war to the federal government is $2.2 trillion. 8. Add interest, since the war is funded primarily from borrowed money. 40% of the war's budget came from foreign countries, and they'll collect interest on it for many years. The total budgetary cost of the Iraq War is $2.8 trillion. Next, we calculate the cost to society. Add the loss of economic output from soldiers' death and disability. The government pays a dead soldier's family $500,000, a sum that's less than what he would earn by pursuing a normal life. And finally, the large-scale economic impact of a war financed by deficits that will divert funds from schools, roads, and research, all against the backdrop of rising oil prices, pushes the tally of war costs over 50 times the original estimate.
So I think that's a good summation of the methodology in the book. Somebody called me up and said, I want to do a video on your book. So I said, fine, do a video on my book. So then they sent me back 6 months later this, and I thought, well, I thought, really. If we take it from the point at which we accept that the war was therefore very expensive, there are a couple of major decisions that were made, which really affected how the war affected the economy. Because once, you know, after the initial decision of whether or not to go to war was made, and taking that decision off and aside, I mean, the next decision really was a decision about who was going to wage this war. And whether, in this case, the sort of choices were, you know, the volunteer army, the reservists, the guards, contractors, or a drafted force. And these are the decisions, these are the choices in terms of waging a war, which affect the economy. And the second decision is how to pay for it, where the choices of how to pay for it include things like a war could be paid for by higher taxes, it could be paid for by the population borrowing money through something like war bonds, could be paid for by spending cuts, it could be paid for by deficits, as we paid for it, you know, or some combination of these. So let's sort of examine these decisions and think about the implications of this. When we think about the financing decision, there are several areas that I want to go over and discuss. Okay, thank you. The decision to finance the war, I would argue, is actually an even worse decision than the decision to go to war the original decision to go to war, because we not only went into the war, but we went into the war, we financed the war in a way which we are all paying for now, but which has essentially concealed the war from the population since the beginning. So I'm going to go over just a few aspects of this decision. You know, first of all, there was the question of estimating how much the war would cost at the beginning. Then there was the question of how you paid for it, as we did through emergency appropriations. Then there was the issue of the transparency and the accounting methods we used in order to keep track of war spending. Fourth, there was the issue of how we thought about veterans' costs and estimated the cost for veterans. You know, fifth, there were a number of sort of short-term financing decisions that led to a much higher cost. And finally, there was the fact that we borrowed all of the money. So these are somewhat interrelated, but I'm going to go through each one of them. At the very outset of the war, once the decision had been made to go to war, there was a very clear decision to lowball the estimate. So you will recall Donald Rumsfeld, then the defense secretary, and the then head of Office of Management and Budget, said that the war would cost $50 billion. Wolfowitz said that the war would pay for itself. And the then National Economic Council chief, Larry Lindsay, who had the job that Larry Summers has now, he said that that was wrong, that the war was going to cost $100 to $200 billion, or 1 to 2% of GDP. Now, there were some in academia who were saying that this was way off. William Nordhaus, who's a very respected economist at Yale, did a study in 2003 2002 that said that if the war went badly, it would cost $2 trillion. But really, his study was, in his words, completely ignored. So even though there were thousands of economists in Washington, thousands of economists all through Washington and at the RAND Corporation and at the Congressional Budget Office and the GAO and every place else, nobody really looked at the issue of what the war would cost. In fact, Larry Lindsay, the economics advisor, was fired, and he later wrote in a book that came out last year that there was a very deliberate suppression of any discussion of the war cost because they felt that that would discourage the country from supporting the war. The second major decision that was made that was very, very unusual and absolutely unprecedented in the history of the United States was the decision to fund the war through so-called emergency appropriations. Now, what emergency appropriations are is they are a funding vehicle. It's kind of technical, but they are a funding vehicle which exists for only two purposes, either to fund a new program that's enacted during the year or to fund an actual emergency, something like Hurricane Katrina, which you could not have anticipated. The way that emergency appropriations worked is that they have several characteristics. They bypass the regular budget controls. They bypass the regular budget caps. And what they mean is that actually, if you fund something through an emergency appropriation, nobody has a chance to look at the huge amount of money that's being appropriated because it goes by very, very fast. It also means that if you are Congressman X and you have a committee, you don't have to make any choices. You don't have to choose between guns and butter. All you have to do is just approve it because this is an emergency money. So it was a very, very unusual way to finance a war. Now, arguably, you could finance a war this way for the initial invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, but in fact, the entire war up until now has been funded through 27 separate emergency appropriations. And I want to point out that this was a bipartisan thing. These things passed almost unanimously. It was in everybody's interest to sort of conceal the true cost of the war. So every single one of these votes, when we heard about the $87 billion and the $79 billion and the $56 billion and so on and so forth, all of these were these supplementary emergency appropriations. Now, this had a number of pernicious effects. First of all, every single year when the president announced the budget deficit, he would say, well, this is our budget. We're going to spend this amount. We're going to get this amount in revenues. And everybody knew there was going to be another $200 billion requested for the war. But in the initial headline, it said, and the media, which did not do a very good job of sort of scrutinizing this, went along with this. What it looked like was that the deficit was going to be, $200 billion or $250 billion, when in fact it was going to be double that. But that never appeared. So year after year, this sort of, the amount was hidden. Secondly, because of the fact that these huge amounts of money, hundreds of billions of dollars were going out so fast with literally three, four, five pages of budget justifications for hundreds of billions of dollars, it was almost inevitable that we would see the kind of war profiteering, the kind of corruption, the kind of overpayments to contractors that we did because nobody had any idea how much anything was costing and nobody had a chance to actually try and figure that out. Finally, in terms of the society at large, we, the public, never had to choose. The Congress never chose and we never chose. We were never kind of given a choice because all this money circumvented the normal budget caps. I would just contrast this whole approach of funding it with the approach used during World War II. If you think about the mobilization campaign for World War II, there was a campaign led by President Roosevelt and by his Treasury Secretary then. It was a seven-point program in which the president actually came out and said, we're going to war, and there's a bunch of things that you've got to do. We've got to curtail consumer spending. You've got to buy war bonds. We're going to raise taxes. We're going to have wage and price and credit controls. We're going to ration consumer things, even though many studies have shown that nothing that was rationed was actually scarce. They just rationed it to sort of bring the whole country around in case something got scarce. And gasoline was also not scarce, but there were restrictions on gasoline. So the whole country was immediately brought into this mentality that we needed to tighten our belts and help wage this war. This thing was important enough that people were going to pay for it. Now, essentially, during the last years, what we have done economically is exactly the opposite of that. Consumer spending has been on a binge, and you can go down the line. They also issued a number of things like stamps and coins and all kinds of things so that people could participate in paying for the war. By contrast, of course, what happened here in 2001 and 2003 as we were going to war were massive, very inequitable tax cuts. Just to kind of give you a glimpse of it, and this comes from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, you know, looking at the effect of the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts, as well as the, you can see, you know, over a period of time, you know, really a huge redistribution of income. This started, you know, even this is over the last 20 years, obviously, you know, a sort of huge redistribution in favor of the top 1%. And this went very heavily to the top 1% of the top 1%. Over the last 8 years. The third issue around the financing of the war is this issue of transparency and how we actually account for war spending. This is an issue which has been uppermost, you know, which I've testified on many times, which I've briefed a number of people, including President Obama when he was a senator, on a number of times, in which you can see is reflected in his new budget, in which the, it seems like common sense, but the war is actually put into the budget, so we can see that it's spent. But the way that our accounting system works that last point should have come after the first point about the emergency supplementals. The way that our accounting system works is that we as a government use what's called cash accounting instead of accrual accounting. Now, if any of you run businesses or if you studied accounting, you know the difference. Cash accounting says, you know, I'm going to buy a car, I'm going to put a $5,000 down payment on it, and I still owe $15,000 on my car, but my budget just shows the $5,000 I've spent this year. That $15,000 doesn't appear, even though I do have to pay it off. No organization larger than a corner grocery store is legally allowed to use cash accounting, but the U.S. government uses cash accounting. In the military, which means that what has happened is that all these long-term costs of war, you know, particularly expensive weapon systems, replacement systems, veterans' costs, and so forth, don't even appear on the books anywhere. So these running costs, I mean, there's no way, for example, that we are not going to spend some $500 billion, which has already been internally approved within the Pentagon for replacing a lot of aircraft that have been worn out flying sorties during the war. But because we haven't actually spent the money yet, it doesn't appear anywhere, even though many of those systems have been already ordered. We also don't have any record of sort of depreciation even, so there's no even accounting way to really understand how bad is the running down of our military equipment. For example, there are 42,000 light vehicles in Iraq. We believe that all of those are going to be a write-off, but nowhere in the accounting does it actually show that. The accounting, such that it was also heavily criticized by anybody who looked at this, including the Pentagon's own inspector general. It really was, to use a technical term, an enormous mess. It was very, very difficult to figure out how much money was being spent. All the accounts were commingled. There was a lot of cross-mingling of money that was meant for the war into the Defense Department accounts and Defense Department regular money into war spending. Because there was all this money kind of coming through, this was this sort of huge bandwagon and a lot of things piled into it. It was very, very difficult to actually really figure out how much money went to Iraq versus Afghanistan, how much money went to various different operations, how many military bases were being spent, how much money were being spent on different military bases. Now, for example, you know, these are big amounts of money. For example, the new U.S. embassy constructed in Baghdad is costing us $750 million to build. This is the most expensive embassy ever built in the history of the world. The embassy that we're building in China, which is our second biggest, is going to cost us $300 million. This thing, which is bigger than the size of Vatican City, the size of 80 football fields, is also going to cost us $1 to $2 billion a year to run in the future every year. Now, none of that appears anywhere. You have to figure this out. So the accounting system, you know, every single military base that we were building was this kind of order of magnitude. Now, in the context of the Iraq War, $750 million is not a lot of money. But in the context of the public schools in Portland, Oregon, it is. You know, so, I mean, the scale was sort of distorted, such the fact that you couldn't even figure out, you know, where the money was going. One of the biggest areas with the most terrible consequences in which this kind of lowballing occurred is in the estimation of the cost of taking care of veterans. No group has sacrificed more than those who have fought in this war because they have been fighting under very, very difficult conditions where they don't know how long they're going to be there. They have the longest tours of duties ever. They are, many of them, subject to what is called stop loss, which means that they signed tiny, tiny fine print, which means they can be extended pretty much indefinitely, not to mention the very grueling conditions of being out there. Those of you who remember back to the initial discussions of the war, remember about how there was all this stuff in the press at the time in 2002 and 2003 about how the war had to be done in the spring because it was too difficult to be in Iraq in the summer because it's 120 degrees and they were carrying these 85-pound packs and people couldn't cope in those situations. But now we've had people who have been out there for 3 years and three summers, you know, and very, very serious injuries of, you know, that have come from just being out there, you know, nasty skin diseases and rashes and leishmaniasis, which are these, you know, dermatological conditions and so forth. Now, we know that these veterans cost a lot. As I was saying before, we know that we pay that 39% of those who fought in the first Gulf War in 1991, we know that they are receiving disability benefits. So we could have made projections to figure out that this was going to be a big cost. But in fact, we didn't. And the result was that the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, has run out of money every year for the past 5 years. Many of the military hospitals, such as Walter Reed, have been substantially underfunded. There are now 600,000 backlogged veterans disability claims. Veterans wait from 6 months to 2 years to get benefits, even if they come back without arms, without legs. So, and the whole lowballing of veterans' estimates was basically a result of using numbers that came from 2001, 2002, before the wars even began, to project the kind of costs and capacity that we would need now. If you think about the kind of veterans' costs, for example, projecting veterans' claims, if 50% of those veterans use the VA healthcare service, you can see, you know, a range of, these are long modeling, but, you know, between 500,000 to 600,000 using it over a period of time to sort of, in a best case scenario, 350,000. Now, in fact, the capacity that now exists for treating things like mild traumatic brain injury, diagnosing post-traumatic stress disorder, is woefully inadequate to what we absolutely know is going to happen. There were many, many instances where we were sort of penny-wise and pound-foolish. For example, in the entire issue of the use of contractors, many of you are familiar with many of the abuses around the contractor issue in Iraq. The way this affects the economy is we now have 190,000 contractors who are in Iraq. That's far more than we have troops. The question is, how does that affect the long-term cost of the war? Well, first of all, it's a question of compared to what? I mean, if all this work had to be done, the decision could have been to raise a much larger military force at home, which would have had a cost and a human cost. We could have decided to have a draft. We could have asked for, there are not that many choices, you know, or we could have essentially privatized the military, which is what we did. Now, privatizing the military seems like a good idea, sort of superficially, because it seems like that's going to be cheaper because you don't have to pay private contractors all these long-term costs. You don't have to pay them veterans' medical care, veterans' disability compensation, and so forth. Private contractors are also, in theory, can do things cheaper and more, in theory, more efficiently. But there were many, many problems with the issue of sort of privatizing so many military functions. For example, private contractors have a different philosophy, and obviously being private contractors are profit-making organizations. So from their perspective, a best-case outcome is a low-cost outcome, whereas it could be that from the U.S. public perspective, a best-case outcome is one that employs more Iraqis. And those can be very, very different things. Let me just give you one example of a sort of a decision, a contractor decision, just to give you a flavor of it. Right now in Iraq, we import all of the sand that's used in Iraq. Now, Iraq, as you know, is mostly desert. Where do we import the sand from? We import it from Kuwait. We import the sand from... Sand is one of the most important things that is used in Iraq because it's used for sandbags, and all of our military use sandbags for everything. Why do we import sand in sandbags from Kuwait? Because in the worst days of the war, when the vehicles were not armored properly, our troops over there making that long, dangerous journey from Kuwait into northern Iraq were sort of improvising by sandbagging their vehicles. Therefore, when the contract went out for actually providing sandbags to the military, Kuwait had a kind of cottage industry in sandbag stuffing. So a no-bid contract was given out to manufacture the sandbags, to stuff them in Kuwait. Kuwait uses third-party contractors from the Philippines and Nepal and other places to actually fill the bags, which are manufactured, the actual bags themselves in Puerto Rico, shipped to Kuwait, stuffed with contractors in Kuwait with Kuwaiti sand, loaded onto trucks, shipped at international oil prices across the desert in Iraq, with security convoys and guarded by U.S. troops, and then unloaded in northern Iraq. Now, it's hard to imagine, if you dreamed it up, something more expensive and less efficient than that. I mean, it would be hard to imagine it. But let's think what else it does. From the perspective of the U.S. policy objectives in Iraq, something which is so... low-tech is filling sandbags is being done by Filipino contractors instead of by Iraqis. From the perspective of the budget, it's a much more expensive way to do this than if local Iraqis were providing sand. And this kind of sort of decision-making, which has gone on in such a kind of large scale throughout, and I could go through 100 examples like that with you, were examples of the sort of contracting decisions that essentially led us astray in the use of the private sector. I could talk for a long time, but I only just touch briefly on the fact that the way the contracts are drawn up with the private sector have largely been cost-plus contracts. That means, if you know contracting, that what contractors are reimbursed for is everything they spend plus a profit. So there is every incentive to spend more because you still get a profit, and there's no incentive to spend less. All of this has significantly increased the cost of the war. The result of all of this, when you bring it all together, is that we've had a very expensive war, essentially run in the most expensive way you could imagine it, and all of this money has been borrowed. Right now, because of the fact that we were running budget deficits at the time we went to war, and we've spent money at the same time that we've cut taxes substantially, all of the money, which has been funded through this emergency supplemental, has essentially not really been spent. It's been borrowed. So it's significantly added to our debt. And you can think about it in sort of three buckets. All this money has to be repaid. We still owe the interest on the money. There's some interest that we've paid. There's interest that we still owe on what we've already borrowed. And then there's a lot of interest still to be paid on what we will still be borrowing to pay all these costs that we haven't paid yet. So that affects our economy in a number of ways. We've added about $1 trillion in the war, to our national debt just directly for Iraq borrowing. One of the direct ways that this affects our budget, before we even think about the rest of the economy, is that interest payments are something that come out of the budget. So, you know, if you think about the federal budget, this is the federal budget from 2007, you know, there is all of the mandatory spending, the entitlements, you know, Social Security and so on. There is discretionary spending. And then there is a third column, which is here in yellow, which is interest. Now, the more you borrow, of course, you have to pay interest. We all know what it's like to pay credit card interest or any other kind of interest. So the cost of borrowing this means that all of that interest is being pushed off into the future. Now, just thinking about the budgetary issues still, just to finish up on the sort of budgetary issues before we go to the overall economic issues, there are a number of consequences of making financing decisions like this. First of all is that if you shield the public from the true costs of the war, as we have been so shielded in this case, in general, a society may be tempted to sort of rush into a war or to go into a war because they don't feel the costs. In this case, we didn't feel the financial cost yet. We also didn't feel the cost in blood because most people were not actually fighting the war. Those, in general, who tend to be in favor of wars the most tend to be those who most underestimate the costs. And we certainly saw that in terms of this war decision, that group of people who were most in favor of the war underestimated the war the most. And finally, the consequence is that the combination of the tax cuts and the borrowing, you know, led to a near doubling of our national debt. And we kind of pick it up now and look at what happened to that. Now, this is the national debt in real terms. And you can see that this bar, you know, goes, that you can see that the national debt started going up precipitously in the mid-80s and has continued to go up. Now, when on the day that President Bush took office, the debt was $5.7 trillion. On the day he left, it was $10.6 trillion, of which a substantial portion of that, you know, was this imbalance between the tax cuts and the huge increase in spending. Spending being Iraq spending directly and associated military spending. And, of course, that doesn't account yet, you know, for the additional spending that we have now spent on the TARP and the financial, on the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac bailout and the stimulus package and so forth. But just looking at this change, the question is, you know, what are the implications of that? And you can see sort of historically, that we have not been in a situation where that percentage of debt as a percentage of our GDP since World War II, you can think about it in terms of the absolute level or in terms of GDP, but you know, we have gone up to a record, and this is before the economy collapsed. If you think about who holds that debt has two components. There is the sort of intragovernmental debt, you know, which is basically money borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund and other governmental funds. And there is the debt held by the public. And because at the same time this was going on, the U.S. savings rate went to zero, we didn't have any money domestically to borrow that money from. So all of this new debt that was purchased and was essentially in that red debt held by the public section was purchased from overseas. You can see at the same time that this debt was going up so much, we also had an enormous surge in household debt. Essentially, this is consumer debt, mortgage debt, credit card debt. You know, and this is what the sort of debt mountain looks like. And all of this debt together, this debt in the society, is what has tipped the economy into a tailspin. The foreign component of the debt, just to kind of give you a flavor of it, Japan is still our largest bondholder, although China by far purchases the majority of our new debt that is issued. But you can see that there is a really, you know, large portion of the country that is exposed to the U.S. economy through the purchase of the, you know, all of this debt. And it is basically all of these countries that have paid for the Iraq war and the fact that at the same time we were cutting taxes so deeply and so inequitably. Now, Another part of this, and I promise you I will pull this all together at the end because there are a lot of different pieces of this that come together, are the sort of direct economic costs of the war. So apart from the social costs that I discussed, there are also expenditure effects. In other words, there are the question of the money that was spent in Iraq, this borrowed money, what did we spend it on? And going back to the sand bag story, a lot of the money literally had no multiplier. And all that money that we spent on producing those polyurethane bags and having Filipino contractors stuff them with sand in Kuwait and transporting them around, that didn't benefit the U.S. economy at all. So even if you take something with a pretty low multiplier in terms of its investment benefit in the U.S., almost anything would have had a higher multiplier than most of the Iraq spending. And a large percentage of the Iraq spending has been spending on meals served to people and laundry services and uniforms that are done and repairs to equipment that are going to be trashed and so forth. You know, things that have no multiplier or very, very low multiplier for the U.S. Another very important economic effect of the war has been a change in the supply and demand equation for oil. Going back to 2003, the oil price, the price of a barrel of oil, was $25 a barrel. And the futures markets, which were already looking at the increasing demand from China and the increasing demand from India and so forth, expected that the price of oil would stay at $25 a barrel for the next decade. Now, the reason was because they saw supply expanding in parallel with demand. Those two things were going up the same. Now, essentially what happened was that the instability introduced by the Iraq war changed the supply curve, not so much by taking Iraqi oil out of production and export, but by making a number of oil producers delay a lot of their refining capacity investments and other investments so that you had the demand going up as expected and a little bit faster. You imagine a curve going like that, but the supply flat curve flattening out and then going up again, but at a much wider divergence from the demand curve, so leading to the enormous increase in oil prices. Oil is a complicated thing. Of course, you know, there you now have the situation where after a lot of pressure from the U.S., particularly in the final years of the Bush administration, a lot of refining capacity was brought online, a lot of supply was increased, then demand dropped as a result of the economy, so now oil prices have become more volatile, so prices have gone down. Now, of course, the oil producers are cutting back on refining capacity, so pretty soon when demand goes up again, oil prices are going to go up again because the supply won't be there. So all of this volatility, which not only adds enormously to the cost of the war because we were transporting sand across the desert at $100 a barrel, but you know also leads to volatility, which is difficult for planning, difficult for the economy. All of those things together bring us to a question, which is sort of thinking back to last summer. What everyone was saying was, okay, well, if all this is so bad, the fact that, you know, the tax cuts have taken away the money, and we're adding all this debt, and we've spent all this money on Iraq, and our consumer savings have gone to zero, and we're borrowing all this money from abroad and so forth, you know, how come everything looks so good? You know, how come the stock market is going so great, and how come everything is going so well? And, you know, the answer really is that the economy was actually substantially weakening. You know, part of the reason the economy was weakening so much was because of all of the impact of all this unproductive investment that was being siphoned off into Iraq, you know, combined with nobody paying for it at home. But this was masked by the fact that the Fed was injecting liquidity into the market, combined with the poor regulation of the housing market and everything attending, you know, on the housing side. So you had sort of these two things coming together. But you really didn't see the underlying weakness. And in fact, if you look at the growth of the economy during the 8 Bush years, which was about 20%, if you pull out all of the money which was basic, that was, if you pull out everything that was attributable just to home equity withdrawals, it was growing at 1%. So it was essentially completely stagnant.